You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun.
The announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate.
The U.S. will soon have a new president and a new political party in charge. But what a brutal and tumultuous process it's been.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. Our country has had enough.
USA! For 4 years, we have witnessed turmoil in America, but nothing quite like this.
When President Trump incited his followers to storm the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, he punctured a 220-year-old tradition in the United States of America. It was gut-wrenching to watch. This marks the first time since the Civil War that the transfer of power from one president to the next cannot be called peaceful. And yet, the peaceful transfer of power is what is at the heart of our democracy, one that countries around the world have tried to emulate. As the world watches, the core of American civic values are threatened by our own president. To many, this happening in the United States was something unimaginable. But to others, the mob attack in Washington was straight from a familiar playbook used instinctively by many authoritarian leaders, past and present. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
Ruth Ben-Ghiad has studied a century of authoritarian strongmen, and she says what's happening in the United States right now is very familiar.
There's no doubt that Donald Trump is an authoritarian leader. He's followed the authoritarian playbook with propaganda, with corruption, with incitements to violence and leader cult since he was running for office. So he's had 4 years to utilize this authoritarian mode of governance where he's domesticated the GOP. Everything becomes his personal tool. All of this background helped him to get to where he was on January 6th.
She says that Trump's actions and words over the past 5 years have led to this moment.
From the beginning of his presidential campaign, he was cultivating the far right and extremist groups and gun groups. And then, you know, when someone becomes president of the United States, it sends a huge message of legitimation. So he took existing extremism and anti-democratic tendencies in the nation and gave them a presidential imprimatur. So this empowered them to a degree they'd never had before. And so that's one background to what we see today, where he tried everything else to stay in power, and then he had already cultivated these people. And the other thing is this cult of victimhood that all authoritarians have, that he also encouraged as part of his cult of personality. And so the two things come together. You know, when the leader is in danger, so these authoritarian leader-follower relationships, it's all about saving the leader at his moment in distress. And so he called on them to come and do what they did.
Ben-Ghiad's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. She just published a timely book, Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. In it, she follows the multiple through lines, the stories that link Mussolini and Hitler and Franco and Marcos and Pinochet and Duterte and Mobutu and Donald Trump. She says Trump fits the mold of a new generation of authoritarian rulers, not to be confused with past autocrats.
Trump is no Hitler or Gaddafi in that authoritarianism works differently today. We don't have one-party dictatorships outside of some communist places like China and North Korea. But the key is that they come in through elections and they must manipulate elections to stay there or get enough power, as Putin and Orban have done, to have parliament pass measures so they could stay in power indefinitely. So Donald Trump was trying a different tack because Americans did something extremely rare. they interrupted with the November election a process of authoritarian capture. And this led Trump to rely on the authoritarian playbook. He tried to first manipulate elections. He explored a military option, which was shut down by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then when all else failed, he tried to rely on these non-state actors, these kind of unofficial paramilitary.
So Donald Trump more closely fits the mold of a modern-day strongman. But how do you explain the enduring appeal, the persistent habit of strongmen over the past century, while at the same time, more people live under elected governments than ever, people are better clothed, better housed than they were 100 years ago?
I think that when you look back over 100 years of this history, which I thought was a really good exercise to do at this point in time, you see certain patterns of times when these kinds of figures have appeal. And one of them is when societies have just completed or are in the process of big social transformations, such as more rights for workers, more gender emancipation, racial emancipation, just all kinds of changes that make some people feel very happy and empowered and make other people very anxious and angry. So it's over and over again. If you think Italy and Germany and Spain in the early 30s, and we can certainly include America after 8 years of Barack Obama, who, you know, many people never thought should have been allowed to be president as an African-American, the conditions can be right for these figures who are always around. But the key is, you know, what makes them successful? What conjunction of conditions have to be there to make people support them and listen to their messages of fear? And this is one of them.
And they present themselves as the guys who, and I use guys because they are all guys, the guys who are going to slam on the brakes, stop the instability, stop the scary stuff, bring the nation, in effect, back to its essence, to its true self. Fair?
Yeah, so that's half of it. And Mussolini, who had been a journalist and was very good with slogans, he defined fascism as a revolution of reaction. And this kind of sums up most of these rulers, because on the one hand, they're there as big red stop signs, like we're going to stop this emancipation, we're going to make women know their place again, people of color won't be, you know, trying to get more rights or be mobile, because this also happened in the decolonization age, right? These are recurring patterns. But on the other hand, they appear on the scene, and some of them come from outside of politics, and they're going to throw everything up for grabs. So they communicate in new ways. They say shocking things. They rejigger alliances. Many of them create their own movements, and a lot of them didn't want them to be parties at first. They had to be movements, so that's more dynamic. So they're a blend of chaos and reaction. And so I find this formulation Mussolini made 100 years ago, actually, in 1920, 2021, he said fascism is a revolution of reaction. It really captures this mix of contradictory impulses that gives these figures their dynamism.
Commonality you identified in a lot of these men is a kind of performative virility, showing off your children, behaving almost as the father of the nation. And in fact, some of them even call themselves that, like the Turkmenistan leader, the Turkmenbashi, who's the head man of all the Turkmen.
Yeah, this is a very important part of their appeal. And one of the, I think, original things of this strongman book is I elevate virility to be a tool of rule alongside propaganda, corruption, the myth of national greatness, and violence. Because I wanted to take this hyper-masculinity seriously. It's easy to laugh at, you know, Mussolini stripping his shirt off. He and Putin are the bookends for this. And Putin uses his half-naked body, not as much anymore, but for many years, used it as a symbol of Russia's strength and the cult of force and all of this. So it's easy to kind of just ridicule it, but it's deadly serious, because not only are they the father of the nation, they're also the protectors. And they are very different than democratic with a small d, leaders who represent the nation. In authoritarian politics, the leader embodies the nation. And this is also connected to the victim cult, because they are the force of the nation, but it means they also take the hits by the nation's enemies. So it's a very different relationship of the leader and the nation, which is also why these men don't recognize public versus private. So they have a proprietary conception of power. It's also why they're corrupt. But I wanted to show that there is a link between these, you know, pictures of half-naked leaders or blustering leaders and social policy. Some of them mobilize women and promote women, but as a whole, women have to, it's pro-family, fear of demographic change, so they want the right people to have more babies. LGBTQ people are persecuted, and that's a through line for 100 years because they're seen as degenerate, or they're not contributing to pro-family politics. So there's links between all of these things, and virility was a very good way to get at all these different issues.
Again and again, along with the writ large throttling of women's ambition society-wide, these men, as you profile them, they're also pretty bad to the women in their lives.
I decided, so these are not biographies. I talk about the leader's character and actions insofar as they connect to their policies and their governing styles. But I did think it was very relevant to talk about the sex addictions that several of them have, from Mussolini to Gaddafi and likely Berlusconi as well, because it's an example of what happens when one person gets power. And this can happen even in democracy, like Berlusconi, who really weakened democracy a lot and bent it around his personal needs, but didn't destroy it. But when one person has all the resources and is able to kind of hijack them to fulfill their personal desires, we hear more about corruption, where they claim the wealth of the nation for their own, but they also claim bodies. And in a way, these strongmen are kind of hoarders. You know, they need our attention 24/7, and they also need a pipeline of women. Gaddafi also had male sexual slaves. But so I talk about how the sex life of the strongman isn't just, you know, sensationalist to write about it, but it actually connects to this proprietary vision of power and this kind of an institutionalization of sexual abuse, a culture of male force that has real consequences.
To give some examples, I mean, I guess Italy was an example of that, where Mussolini's own noted and widely known dalliances seemed to be a kind of license for other men. He wasn't the only guy who was allowed to play around. It sort of authorized black shirts to be roues like their boss.
Yeah, because the leader is the emblem of manhood. And it's really interesting. These men, and many of them come to power with some background in communications or entertainment. So they know how to be the kind of man the culture wants them to be. And this is very important. They're con men, but they're also showmen. And I'm taking this very seriously. So in Mussolini's case, he used his secret police and his personal secretariat to vet women. If you went to a rally and he saw a woman who seemed pretty, or someone wrote him a letter with a picture, he would have them tracked and invited to his office, which is where he did everything, and then violate them. We have no idea if it was consensual or not. And after that, they would be persons of interest to his entire secret police network. And Gaddafi went one step further and actually had sexual captives in the basements of his compound. And at the University of Tripoli, had a dungeon built, so because he would go and visit universities and select his latest captives. But this set the tone for a kind of widespread culture of sexual abuse and just domination. And so the leader's example is followed by other men, and then it translates into social policy, where sometimes women's rights are taken away in dictatorships. But even in democracy, misogyny can be generalized and normalized, which has also happened when someone like Trump comes to power, who boasted about, you know, grabbing women's private parts. And so the book takes on the consequences of this certain fetish we've had, or toleration of male glamour, the glamour of male lawlessness and the glamour of male force. And it's arguing that it's showing historically up to today that this has disastrous consequences, and perhaps we need something else.
One of the most fascinating things about that, this whole set of interlocked syndromes that you describe, is that these leaders often come to power promising or assuring the country that they are the answer, they are the antidote to the instability and lawlessness and corruption of a previous regime. I will sweep all that away. Yet they also expect, or do they expect, a kind of tolerance, as there's a growing understanding of their own corruption, where they don't expect it to tarnish them. They don't expect wider knowledge of the fact that they're getting rich, sometimes unbelievably wealthy, to detract from their power or detract from their credibility.
Yeah, that's a very interesting syndrome that you describe, and it's been repeated over and over for a century. These men, again, many of them have criminal records when they come to power, or they're under investigation, like Putin and Trump and Berlusconi, all under investigation when they were coming to running for office. And they claim to be purists who are going to, quote, drain the swamps, which is, by the way, a slogan that Mussolini first used. And he meant it literally. He was going to drain these swamps south of Rome that had malaria, and he did it. But it also quickly became a kind of term used for his cleaning up society. And of course, the targets of who was unclean and who was degenerate and who was immoral widened from the left to Jews to the bourgeois. And that's always what happens in authoritarian rulers. It's never just one target. They widen the group of people that get persecuted. But this combination of law and order rhetoric and lawlessness is at the very heart of authoritarian rule. And another contemporary example is Bolsonaro, who, like Berlusconi, came to power on the heels of a corruption scandal, and was able to say, I'm going to be a reformer. I'm going to clean everything up. And then, you know, and used the law and order rhetoric, in his case, connecting to the Brazilian military dictatorship. So one of the clues we have is this: if we see a politician on the rise and we see, is this person a strongman? They start talking about violence. They start talking about their own purity, law and order. And then when they get into office, they do the opposite. And soon enough, they, especially if they don't ruin democracy, were able to see how they institutionalize corruption in their governments.
Is this an aspect of the way they try to control reality? This sort of chasm between who they say they are and what they want to accomplish and what they actually do? Is it just an outgrowth of the kind of things they do to the press, or the fabulous stories they spin in their speeches that have no connection to reality but are expected to be believed?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. They all have to start off by destroying the notion of truth, but it's interlocked with the other tools because, for example, we can take Trump as an example, but the syndrome is the same. When he was on the campaign trail, he immediately started demonizing the press. And one of the things, now he's leaving, we can, you know, think about what are his legacies, this kind of making the press a political enemy to an extent it never was before, that they should be locked up, right? This is new. But the reason they do that, it's like an insurance policy. Because they're corrupt, they know that secrets could come out, and they need people to already believe that the press is against them, that they are the victims of plots, of prosecutors, of the press. And they need people to feel that whatever the press is going to say is biased, that these are partisan hacks. The other part of the dynamic is that they they bond people to them. And so Trump used loyalty oaths. And he spoke, and they speak in very direct ways, and they channel these, they use negative emotions, but they also have positive connections on an emotional basis. They make people feel included, the right people, usually white Christian people. And so people start to believe in them. And once they believe in them, they'll believe anything they say. And then there's the final part, which is some of them know that in the Trump case, he was lying, but they didn't care because Trump posed as a maverick who was going to throw everything up for grabs. He was going to give a jolt to the system. And they saw his lying as a kind of rule breaking. And here we go back to the outlaw, the lawlessness. So all of this becomes a real difficult thing to combat. And over and over, they've been very successful in attacking the truth and establishing their own version of reality, which keeps them in office.
You know, that's one thing in a illiterate society, a pre-literate society. But Adolf Hitler came to power in the most literate, most educated society in the world at that time. So it doesn't necessarily follow, does it, that the sophistication of the populace itself is really an important variable here. It could happen anywhere.
Yes. And one of the lessons of the book is it can happen anywhere, and that the mechanisms are the same. The outcome is very different. I'm a historian, so the book really respects the differences in outcome of the fascist era, where you had these genocidal dictatorships, military coups, and then what happens today. So the outcome can be different, but the dynamics are the same. I have an incredible poster in the book from the Nazi Party in the 1920s. So Hitler, you know, Mussolini got to power in 1922, and it took him a whole decade after that to get to power. And he idolized Mussolini and was trying to do a march on Berlin that was like Mussolini's march on Rome. So he paid very close attention to what Mussolini was doing. And he was banned from speaking publicly in the mid-1920s because of his hate speech. So, and this was done at the state's level, not the national level. So the Nazi Party put out a poster of Hitler with his mouth taped shut. And so today we talk about cancel culture. So he posed as a truth teller who had been silenced by the establishment media, by liberal democracy, which was tyranny, right? This is the fascist line that's still around with Orban and the American right today. And this was highly effective. He was this maverick who was risking everything. He'd even gone to prison when his putsch failed in 1923. And there were several editions of this poster of Hitler with his mouth taped shut. And then he got the ban rescinded because he said he would abide by the law. He would obey the Constitution. And of course, the rest is history. He, you know, about 5 years after that, he was in power. So the truth teller who comes from outside and is risking for the nation, this is very powerful for people. And time and again, even if they're in a highly educated nation, whatever the specifics are, it works to solidify the bond around the leader.
On one hand, people can find out more things about more things than ever in the history of the world. And it seems like almost a paradox that at a time when you can be more informed about everything, that same set of tools can also be put to work, making you ignorant or, just as easily as the truth can be found, fantastic flights of fancy can be found that help you believe or swallow all kinds of things. How have modern communications played into the latest iteration of strongmen?
That's a really interesting question. And I want to say that every chapter goes over 100 years. So I have a propaganda chapter, and it goes from 1920s to today. So the reader can see exactly what's changed and what's stayed the same. So one of the things that stays the same is that these leaders establish direct communications with the people. Now, the type of media changes. Mussolini had newsreels, and Trump has Twitter, so does Bolsonaro. But it's very important that they have that direct line of unmediated contact with their people. So social media has accelerated certain tendencies of propaganda, because propaganda requires repetition, but it also requires saturation. The same message has to be hammered home through different, you know, and before it was radio, newsreels, and print. Now we also have social media. And the way that information circulates so quickly today allows misinformation, disinformation to do its impact much, much faster. So you could say, as I do in the book, what modern 21st century authoritarians, and I'm not speaking of the remaining one-party states like North Korea and China, I'm talking about where there's some semblance of open media still, they lose this ability to control everything. Like there's no one state media in Brazil. Orban's come pretty close, but there's always some opposition voices. So they lose that total synchronization, but they gain in saturation and they gain in repetition. And so that is very destructive. So I have a lot about social media in the book, also in the resistance chapter, to show how people today use social media to engage in digital storytelling that creates communities around dissent. So I have an example of a classic scene from Resistance where the police are breaking down your door and you have to hide your documents with your contacts' names. Before, we would never be able to see this because we would read about it in memoirs when people go into exile, things like that. We didn't have a real-time record. Now, critics and dissidents in Putin's Russia are live streaming when the police knock on their door. So I have an example of a guy live streamed on Twitter, his drone flying his hard drive out his window of his apartment to a friend. So we see, we're privy to these moments, and this actually creates a lot more empathy and solidarity with dissidents today. So that's an example where social media harms autocrats.
Social media also encourages and enforces conformism. I mean, when you go in the process of a few weeks from election day to north of 70% of the members of a political party believing that a vote was totally fraudulent, that an election was rigged and controlled, that's a kind of power. The ability to get that message out into people's eardrums and eyeballs day after day after day, Hitler and Mussolini would have been jealous, I guess. It's because it's pretty powerful stuff.
It is. And, you know, it's very common for people to say that Trump is incompetent, he's lazy. And I think this is not a useful thing to say to understand what the magnitude of what has happened to us in these years, because I truly believe, you know, Trump did not have the same goals as Democratic presidents with a small d. He had zero interest in public welfare. That's why he couldn't care less about coronavirus, if Americans live or die. He just doesn't care. And in that, unfortunately, he shares the exact psychology of all these other leaders I write about. But his goals were to make money for Trump Organization, and that's why he's been golfing and visiting so many Trump properties, one out of every 3 days in office. But his other goal was to build his personality cult to keep people loyal to him and to hammer home his messages so that would help him to, you know, keep people's affection and keep the hatred of enemies, because he needs people to be polarized. So the magnitude of what he has done since his 2016 campaign, we've hardly begun to analyze. And we have been subjected by Trump and his allies in the media and government to a barrage of psychological warfare and messaging that is unprecedented in American history and in peacetime, for sure. So he's been highly successful at the things he cared about, and propaganda was one of them. One of the biggest dangers we face now is that Trump has left a blueprint for everyone to see of where our institutions are weak. They worked. He was, you know, his electoral manipulations were pushed back at the local level. We managed to vote in numbers sufficient, despite voter repression and pandemic, to vote him out. But the GOP is likely to double down on its all the things it's learned from Trump to delegitimate the Biden-Harris administration, because they've seen that it works. Fear works, scaremongering works. And I also think that a lot of people were highly invested till the very end in consolidating what they'd started. I have zero doubt that William Barr, all the things he was trying to do, he asked Congress if he could detain people without trial. That's like what juntas do. And so there was a blueprint there to have a kind of an authoritarian exercise of power. So someone else could now come along and they see the potential for people to accept this. That's the real danger.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. We're talking about strong men rulers, from Mussolini to Trump. And now, let's return to Ray Suarez's conversation with historian Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
For all the norm busting, for all the limits testing, it turned out there were norms that mattered. Limits that mattered. Is the way that we gauge the effectiveness of strong men the eventual ability they have to erode all norms, push past all limits? And do they only succeed to the extent that they're able to do that?
Yes. I mean, it's here we have to look at the effect of violence. And when you have it classically happens when, you know, you have full control of the state and then you have secret police and law enforcement who kill people. And thus, everyone else is so terrified, they comply. In 21st century, it works differently. Orban is an example. He hasn't used much violence at all. And he's been able to domesticate society, and he now rules by decree. So he's been able to get compliance very craftily that way. But, you know, to push back our institutions held, but sometimes it came down to a few people doing the right thing, like these election officials or judges or General Milley, who, you know, was used as a prop in Lafayette Square. And that whole summer, the response to Black Lives Matter protests, the mobilization of all these troops, this was a rehearsal for the election era and after. This was very clear to me at the time. And General Milley was used as a prop. He didn't like it. So a few weeks ago, he came out and said, oh, well, the armed forces is only going to obey the Constitution, not an individual. But the reason he said that is that Trump was clearly probing about if he could use the military in a repressive way because the electoral thing wasn't going so well for him. So in a way, we our institutions held, but it also depended on a few prominent people to set the tone. And that has to be celebrated, just like the election results. But it also means that, you know, we're up against this authoritarian political culture that the GOP has normalized now under Trump's lead. And we're going to have a very vigorous pushback so that that doesn't spread further.
There's still some time to go before January 20th. He has reportedly asked again and again, for instance, whether he can pardon himself. And on one level, you think, oh, well, that's reassuring. Pardons actually still matter, because in some of the societies that you describe in the book, you know, who did Pinochet need to pardon him? Who would Mussolini need to pardon him? Nobody. They were the law. So there is still a recognition that these kinds of things still matter. Can I pardon my kids? What can I pardon them for? And on and on and on. So I'm not going to prejudge what happens between now. There may still be some pretty eye-opening pardons still to come. But just the fact that there was that kind of thing, him finding out what the limits were, him being told what they were and then trying to think about how he might circumvent or wiggle past it. That's still a kind of recognition that the law kind of still matters.
Yeah, it's a reluctant recognition on his part because he's never had any limits in his life. He's managed to come back from bankruptcies and get more and more banks to lend him money. He's been a lawless individual who's been rewarded for that. But so on the individual level, yes, this chief, bullion chief, has learned finally that there's some limits. We are still waiting for a full accounting of the total disaster that has happened to our federal bureaucracy. I write about this in Strongman. In the State Department, the EPA, the Centers for Disease Control, this has been an authoritarian style purge. You know, again, in 20th century, the purge would mean you go to prison. Here you get fired or you're forced out with a hostile workplace. But tens of thousands of people have left, and he's substituted them with loyalists. And so in the book I explore, in the corruption chapter, it's not just financial corruption. It's creating a climate, because corruption is contagious. If other people are doing it and you get away with it, it encourages more people to do it. But you have to have people who set the tone. So from things that could seem small, like violating the Hatch Act, they never were small before, but dozens of his employees have violated it because now it's okay. So there's lessons, for example, from the Berlusconi era in Italy, where Berlusconi was highly corrupt and wrapped the law around his little finger. And over his two governments of the early 2000s, he really normalized corruption. And there are polls of citizens where their appetite for corruption, was greater because they got used to it. And they expected less of government. They became more cynical. And this fueled the far-right populism in that country. So I really think we haven't begun to digest what he has done, the decimation and devastation he has caused to governmental ethics. So he might learn limits, but a lot of those employees are still there, that he put them there to change the culture. And that's something we'll have to reckon with.
As you note in the book, the act doesn't last forever. People become more and more dissatisfied as the ideal and the real move further and further apart. One response many of the men you portray share is to depict everything that happened before them as terrible, and everything that's happened since them as great, a kind of golden age for the country. Are there similarities in the way it begins to unravel? I got a chuckle out of it when you noted for several of them that one metric is when people stop asking for their autograph or their picture, you know something's up.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the most interesting chapter to write, the endings chapter, because it concentrates on, you know, how do each of these people who I feature, how their ending goes. But also it's the unraveling of a style of rule that's built around loyalty to their person and what happens when conditions change. And the bad news is that it takes an awful lot. And this is true when there's really been a one-party state and state media and you don't have other, you know, messages getting in easily. So for Hitler and Mussolini, it really took their countries being bombed by the Allies. So, you know, total devastation. That's when in 1942 or so, people started to insult the leader publicly. And so people, that's a very good example, like the autographs you mentioned too. People were afraid you couldn't insult the leader. You'd go to jail. You could go to jail for 10 years for one, you know, errant word in public. And there were so many informers that this was a big deal. But then the people started, they saw a huge uptick in people insulting the leader publicly because they began to lose their fear. They didn't care anymore because they realized what he was. And even Mussolini's own daughter started to realize that he had, you know, wrecked the country. And so she writes him an angry letter because she sees all this poverty in Sicily. So that process of unraveling is very, very interesting. But it takes a lot to get people to give up their leader.
It also creates an incentive for the leader to not tolerate even the most marginal, even the most petty forms of dissent, making jokes, funny cartoons. You can't, there's almost this feeling like it's a slippery slope, that if you allow any of it, you have to allow it all. So this network that you mentioned of informants and secret police and block monitors and all that, criminalize even the smallest attempts to hold on to a little bit of yourself that isn't in thrall to the leader. It's scary.
Yeah, it is, because authoritarianism thrives when there's mistrust and abject fear. And one of the sub-themes of the book is exile. How I really wanted to take on this idea that authoritarianism is good government and it's efficient and it's good for business. And I really wanted to show the destruction it causes to the economy, but also to family life and the texture of society. So many people, you know, all this talented people, they're either in prison or they have to go into exile. And like journalists, for example, in Mussolini's Italy, if you were a dissident journalist, if you were lucky, you fled the country, but then they would go after your family who's still there. So this mistrust and fear just reigns, and it's very effective. Now, today, you know, that's a bit less because the penalties are less if you don't have a one-party state. But the creation, the attempt to destroy the horizontal bonds of community by spreading hatred still is the same. That's why Donald Trump started with creating enemies. He weaponized old enemies, like, you know, people against African Americans, against Muslims, and migrants. And then to those older enemies, he added newer enemies, the press. And then anybody who didn't agree with him became, at his governmental level, they became disloyal and they were booted out of government. And then at the social level, they became political enemies, people to threaten from his Twitter feed. So it's been to see how people became afraid to speak out quite quickly, even here where we retained an open society, shows that the power of these, that these leaders have and their threats that they thrive on.
But do we have to be careful? I mean, at long last, Trump is not Mussolini. We don't have a network of prisons scattered around the country filled to the brim with political prisoners. We don't have black-shirted secret police, you know, enforcing even the slightest deviation of norms. Or Viktor Orban is not Hitler. Duterte is not Stalin. It all seems to be calibrated on a whole different chart. Using the tools of the modern state and using some of the tools of modern communication, but I feel almost like we have to be a little cautious with some of these parallels. Or would you disagree with me there?
No, I agree. And one reason, you know, I've been studying fascism for years, and so everyone asks me if Trump is a fascist. And I won't call him a fascist because it doesn't work the same way today. And the conditions that created these one-party dictatorships are they're still around in the communist world, but it really does work differently today. There's less genocidal violence. There's less mass public violence. There's more mass detention. So everybody has their migrants in detention camps. And Erdogan's a good example. He's arrested hundreds of thousands of people who are critics of him. He hasn't used the tools that 20th century, he hasn't used all of those tools. They detained people en masse as well, but they also killed more people. And that's become more difficult to do in the social media age. And that's also why they warehouse their enemies and do things inside camps often. But it's very important to respect the differences between 21st and 20th century, which is why I use the word authoritarian for all of these leaders, and then I divide them into different ages. But the book shows how, although some of the tools they use are exactly the same, the personality cults, the threats, but the outcomes are different. But other things that remain the same are also how we misjudge them. And that's one of the most interesting things in the book. Time after time, when these people appear on the scene, they are misjudged. For example, elites think they can bring them into the system and use them, just like the Italians and Germans did in the early 20th, the GOP did in 2016. And they thought that they could control Trump or that he would become presidential. And this is the pivot delusion. He's going to become something else. He's going to become normal. And this is a profound misreading of who these extremists are. And this has happened over and over again. So I think that one of the lessons of the book is that although things work differently today and outcomes are different, the psychological and social impulses that produce these men's success haven't actually changed all that much.
I'm glad you brought up Erdogan because he's an interesting case. He starts out as a leader with a number of champions in the West. The EU is moving ahead with a possible Turkish entrance into the Union as a member state. Erdogan is barred by some legal technicality from running for prime minister or president. A former admired, successful mayor of Istanbul, said to have brought the city back from the brink. He prevails in a legal sense. He wins in a democratic sense. He starts out his first couple of victory laps. He's looking pretty good. And then something changes. And you start to see the hallmarks of authoritarian rule. You start to see the targeting of critics and the harsh punishment of dissent that early on, well, you might not have imagined that it was going to go that way. Turkey will now never be in the EU in an Erdoganist structure. It is throttling the origin points of dissent. It is trying to keep opposition politicians out of power. It's knocking people off of ballots. It's doing all kinds of stuff that would have made it impossible even to be in the polite company of Western nations. Now, some observers have said, well, once it was clear that the EU was going to keep messing them around, that relationship curdled and he went his own way. Or he was willing to play the democratic game as long as it advantaged him. And then once he had all the tools he needed in his hands to be who he really was, then he came roaring out of his shell and became the guy he is today. It's hard to figure. I've interviewed him a couple of times. He was somebody who was looked to as a modernizer, as someone who was going to drag Turkey into the 21st century with the force of his personality, but also with the support of his people. And now it looks entirely different.
He's in the book in most chapters. He's an excellent example. And he poses, as you said, as this modernizer and new infrastructure, new airports and highways, and a lot of them paid for by mountains of foreign debt. But he's also interesting because one of the hallmarks of these leaders and their personality cults is that they pose as people making the nation great in the future. So they're future oriented. That's the modernizer. But they also play on nostalgia because it's never make America great. It's always make America great again. So in Erdogan's case, Mussolini had the Roman Empire. Erdogan talks about the Ottoman Empire. And there's some very chilling quotes that, I've gathered from him where he says that Turkey's borders are going to extend, into Greece, into other, countries that are not currently his territory. So they're able to be a mix of answering desires for their country to have more prestige, and that prestige might be modernity, but it's also some vague desire to return to when things were great again.
In some cases, in the countries that you touch on in the book, the experience of life under a man like this is so frightening, so traumatizing, that when you rebuild your politics after he's gone, you make it really hard to have a guy like that again. So Italy has 45 different cabinets after the fall of Mussolini and the end of the monarchy. You have a Germany that goes so far in repenting of Hitlerism that it totally remakes itself and its own memory about its history. But then, on the other hand, you have a Russia which, after decades and decades of really harsh one-man rule and cults of personality, with just a brief but crazy and unstable interregnum, goes back to Putinism, almost like the reflex of a muscle. You're not that far away from Brezhnev, and suddenly there's Putin.
Yeah, and that's Putin is in the book as an example. So I don't deal with 20th century communists because I'm a historian of fascism, and I mostly stuck to right-wing authoritarians. And I also wanted to look at people who wrecked a democracy and didn't inherit this closed system like the Soviets. But Putin's very interesting because he draws so much on the legacy of the Soviet Union in ways that don't get talked about perhaps enough, not just that he was in the KGB and all of his methods that retain something of Soviet political violence, but he uses, you know, some of the penal colonies where he ships many more people than we're made aware of are the same, you know, Soviet era penal colonies. One of the reasons I wrote the book is that we're in this period of intense historical revisionism by authoritarians themselves. So Putin's been very busy in that regard. And, you know, it's illegal to mention the Nazi-Soviet pact. And I always tell my students when I teach World War II, if I wouldn't be able to mention this. If I were in Russia, I would go to jail. And there are several historians sitting in his gulags for working on the wrong things. So he's putting up statues of Stalin, but he's punishing anybody who looks too closely into parts of the gulags that weren't known about before. So I think that one of the things the book wants to show is the recurrences and the kind of through lines of this century of authoritarianism, and both the right and from communist to post-communist. And you have Orban, too, who was a dissident and then turned into an authoritarian. So that's a different trajectory.
Well, here we are, a fifth of the way through a new century, and you've got Viktor Orban with fantasies of uniting Hungarian-speaking people who are scattered through not only Hungary, but in countries elsewhere in Europe, a greater Hungary, lamenting the World War I era treaties that created Hungary's modern borders. You have Modi in India with the remembrance of something that never was or hasn't been in anybody's memory, a Hindu-only India, not in centuries and centuries, but sort of building fantasies of the future around something that never was. You've got Putin trying to re-enthuse his people about a greater Russia. It seems like this is a contagion we never quite develop the antibodies to resist. As we look forward, are more men going to try this rather than fewer?
Yes, it's been very consistently something that brings popularity you tell people the present is, you know, full of threats. Look how Trump said, you know, that America's a rusted out landscape. It's a terrible place. And then you package to them and market to them this ideal nation. So I actually added this chapter called A Greater Nation because I had so many elements of, you know, the exile nation, then the appeals to the diaspora, and I was trying to fit them in different chapters, and I thought, you know what, there's so many recurrences over a century, I'm going to give it its own chapter. So that's what the greater nation is, and Mussolini was the first to appeal to the diaspora. All the little Italies all over the world were called into service, and there were many Italian anti-fascists living abroad, but there were also a lot of fascists, and they felt great pride in Mussolini that finally people were taking Italy seriously. So this formula is used. Look at Modi, who's very interesting, his use of communications to go back to the propaganda theme, where he appears at rallies by hologram so that he can be everywhere at once, which is part of the personality cult. And so people want to dream. And these leaders are expert communicators, and they're able to make people dream, though the dreams are highly destructive in the end. But in the meantime, they make people feel hope, and they make people feel proud of their nation. And you know, you see many Trump supporters say he's with us and he's making America great. And Trump's been very smart about giving them red hats and letting them feel like a tribe that takes pride in the nation. So we haven't seen the last of this because it works. And it works around the world in many, many different historical eras. And they all learn from each other. In some way, they admire each other and they look at what works and what doesn't. Donald Trump is not done yet. He waited a very long time on January 6th to tell them to stand down, and he said it's time to go home. But it's very important that he added that this election was stolen from us. So it was a kind of standing down but not giving up. And in fact, both in terms of his personality, and he's like all the other autocrats I've studied, defeat is not an option because losing power is a kind of psychological annihilation for leaders like Trump. They can't imagine not having control and adulation. It's like a death for them. And the other thing is, if they concede, they'll lose the respect of their followers. And Donald Trump's been extremely successful in keeping these 70 million plus people who voted for him, more people than in 2016, despite criminal mismanagement of the pandemic. He's keeping them in their fiction that he is the winner. That's very important. So he's not giving up. He's not going to go quietly, and he will have to be removed, or there will be more instability in the weeks to come.
As we look ahead in the United States, we're offered those two models of either totally being so scared off by what we just experienced that we don't risk it again, or dabbling with it, you know, not being scared off by it. What do you make of our temper now as Joe Biden prepares to take the oath of office?
I think on the one hand, we have learned that things are much more fragile than we thought. And in particular, many white people who had perhaps not thought of the state as a hostile force to them now see that things can turn very quickly and they can become political enemies. I think we're in for a turbulent time. I think that the strategy of the GOP is going to be to paint the Biden administration as a kind of socialist apocalypse and make things as difficult to govern as possible with the aim of recapturing the White House. So we haven't seen the last of Trumpism. And I can only hope, as someone not a fan of authoritarian political cultures, that democracy protection is something you have to work into your everyday life and you can't take your rights for granted.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. She teaches history and Italian studies at New York University. Great to have you with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. Our program is co-produced with KQED. World Affairs is a nonprofit organization. Please consider making a donation to support the programming you value. Just go to our website at worldaffairs.org/donate. And while you're at it, we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? What topics would you like us to cover in 2021? Our email address is feedback@worldaffairs.org. World Affairs is produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, and Teresa Katsourilis. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our digital producer is Tatum Sanderbeck. And our intern is Temba Daniels. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.